This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie.
What's going on, Katie?
So much. Broken computers, job changes, Appalachian Trail hikes, you know, the fucking works. I don't have much to say about it quite yet, but I will have more to say about it later. Because Ash can edit out that I'm
Yes, there is a big event coming up, but we just have to be very secretive about it right now.
Yes. I also will talk about my job and we'll talk about a lot of stuff next time. Things have been wild. Thank you all so much for understanding this longer than realized break that we took. Mental health, you know, all the stuff.
Sometimes life loves to just pile everything on all at once and then it gets overwhelming.
Yeah. And there was a little bit of me seeing ahead and being like, things are going to get bad soon, aren't they? Yeah. And trying to like prepare for that. So, you know, be honest with yourself. Don't forget that your best is what you can do when you're taking care of yourself, not what you can get done when you ignore everything you need to be good. How are you, Ashley?
I'm good. I was just with you and that was fun. And we walked the Appalachian Trail together.
We did.
For 3 miles. For the first time for both of us. We did.
It was so fun.
Katie quit her job and then we decided to go for a hike.
And that's how it goes.
And you went, you know, it's only 40 minutes from us.
It's really not that far.
And it was beautiful. Oh my God, the colors.
Perfect time for it.
The oranges, the yellows. Oh my God. We walked our own witch's road and made a fucking TikTok video.
Amazing.
We were in the woods and I just went, you know, this would be the absolute perfect time to do the broom dance from Agatha All Along. Brilliant. And I literally hung my phone on a tree to get that video.
Oh, that was so smart too.
Right? I have a little loop on the top of my phone because I have a handle on my phone case because I'm a person who drops it a lot. And I was like, oh my God, let's just stick this on the edge of a tiny little tree branch hanging out. It was perfect.
Brilliance.
So it was a nice weekend with you. I love getting out of New Jersey for the weekend to visit you.
Yeah, it was so much fun. We did not go to the Ren Fair because they are sold out through the rest of the year.
Insane.
Apparently, and not apparently, because once it was pointed out to me by Brenna at Plantbox, I was like, oh, you know what? I hadn't even thought about that. But the PA Ren Fair specifically is going pretty viral on TikTok.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not surprised.
Yeah. You know what? Good for them, though. Good for them.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, we got to get our Yuletide tickets like now.
Oh my God. Now. Since I'm not going to Florida this year.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Got to get it.
So that was a nice weekend with you. We went to downtown York, and apparently there was a Halloween bar crawl happening. We did not do that. We just went to different cute shops. I got a Plant Daddy water bottle that I then proceeded to let fly off of the top of Katie's car as we were heading to the Appalachian Trail when we got to a stop sign in her neighborhood, and that she just yeeted into the intersection. I broke the plastic top, but the rest of it is fine.
It's good.
It's good. We ran into a cute dog named Pierre at a very cute vintage shop there in town, which I will tell you the name of next episode because I do want to shout them out because it's super cute and they do online ordering. And I just can't remember right now. And it was great. It was a good time.
It was an excellent weekend. Watched all of The English Teacher. Oh, obsessed with that show. Obsessed with that
so
little
good.
Gay guy's dances. My little Fruit Loop.
Well, we're on our first technical difficulty of the night. So why don't we get into it?
Yes, we left off. Oh my God, thank God. Last week we left off in 1996 with the introduction of OxyContin.
Last week.
That's what my note said. Last episode. Oh, Beetlejuice, are you going to jump down and cause a ruckus? Purdue Pharma, owned by the Sackler family, introduced OxyContin, an opioid pain medication, and marketed it as safe, non-addictive, and completely downplayed the addiction risks. They hired a large sales force that was incentivized with bonuses to promote OxyContin to healthcare providers, and the representatives were trained to reassure doctors that OxyContin was safer and less addictive than other opioids, despite a lack of scientific evidence supporting these claims. Let me see if I can find the video. And I just want to kind of outline what this was like. They had, like, you know, medical conventions, and that's not a new concept. At one of their conventions, they essentially Weird Al, "You Make Me Want to Shout," and turned it into a sales celebration song.
No. This is like when we used to do our like quarterly
banquets,
and they like made us for each grade pick a song and rewrite the lyrics to be about us and then do a dance with it.
Yep, it was exactly like that. Oh, get to the song.
You make me want to sell.
Yeah.
No, there was way too much enthusiasm from literally every single person in that room.
Oh, and they were so fucking thrilled about it.
I'm eating it up. It's like an MLM.
An MLM with drugs. Their key selling point was that OxyContin was a long-acting formulation providing 12 hours of relief compared to the other opioids. And this feature was supposed to make it safer and less likely to cause addiction. And that is their entire basis for everything. It's important to note that in practice, the 12-hour duration was not always accurate, and that had led some patients to take higher doses and more frequent doses, which then increases the risk of addiction and overdose. OxyContin would be a revolutionary drug, Richard Sackler told the reps. Quote, "You will revolutionize the treatment of both chronic cancer pain and of non-malignant painful conditions as well," end quote. So they're being told, like, you're going to be heroes, basically. If a doctor, like, they were told, like, if a doctor is prescribing any type of painkiller, you need to switch them to Oxy. Even if they're prescribing MS Cotton, our pill, switch them to Oxy.
Wow.
They were told to cannibalize their own market and switch them to this. And it's not because they loved this drug.
That's a wild choice. Are you okay?
Oh, I thought someone was knocking. Gio's digging into the couch. It sounded like really light knocks. Yeah, it's not because they were like, we believe in this drug so much. It's because it made them so much fucking money. Mm-hmm. They knew that everyone that would be taking it would absolutely be addicted to it. The reps went beyond the assurances of the label, which I want to be clear, that's not necessarily something that's only happening with painkillers. Yeah. There are a lot of medications that are prescribed for off-label usage, and I don't necessarily have my own belief as to what doctors, whatever. But I wanted to note that reps were doing that and were instructed to inform doctors that, quote, fewer than 1% of patients who took OxyContin were being addicted. In all ways, people are being assured this is super safe and you can use it for everything. We discussed in the last episode about how they were told to present all of the information and how they were told to present addiction and what causes addiction. They talked about, like, the peaks and troughs phenomenon. And they were insisting that OxyContin release this, quote, payload into the bloodstream gradually. So the peaks and valleys were less pronounced, making addiction less likely. They probably were saying this in their sleep at this point. At Purdue headquarters in Norwalk, a story circulated about the time that Richard Sackler supposedly popped an Oxy himself and went into a meeting in order to specifically demonstrate that it would not make him high or impair his functioning at all. I don't know if that's true, but there was like lore surrounding.
They're like, this man was audacious enough to do this move.
It's totally fine.
Let me prove it to you. Look at me. I'm the guinea pig. I wouldn't take it if it was bad.
Exactly. It's that moment in every environmental law case where it's like, would you drink the water?
Yeah.
I think I would freak out if I saw any of this now. But they're distributing, quote, dizzying variety of OxyContin swag. So they have fishing hats, plush toys, luggage tags, shirts, just like.
Oh my, not a plush toy. What is it of? The pill?
I think so.
Stop.
I think so. I couldn't find it.
Can you imagine if people were like giving that to their kids? I bet they were.
Oh, I'm sure they were. Sure they were. Quote, the sales reps left a trail of these giveaways wherever they went so that anywhere a doctor turned, they would be greeted by reminders of the product.
They're like hype bros.
Exactly. They're hype bros, they're influencers, and these are their swag bags.
Oh my God.
Just as Arthur did, quote, physicians often scoffed at the suggestion that their prescribing habits might be swayed by the gifts of pharmaceutical companies, end quote. In Arthur's view, it was laughable, even insulting, to insinuate that a colorful ad or a steak dinner might be enough to sway clinical judgment of an MD. Doctors, he argued, simply can't be bought.
I think you're forgetting that they're also just people.
Exactly. According to Empire Pain, a 2016 study found that purchasing even a single meal with a value of $20 for a physician can be enough to change the way that he prescribes. And for all of their lip service to the contrary, the Sacklers didn't need studies to tell them this. Some years, Purdue would allocate as much as $9 million just to buy food for doctors. End quote. They knew the whole time.
They knew exactly what they were doing.
Exactly. Because they, at their core, were also an ad agency. They were raised in order to be able to present themselves perfectly. In a 1996 email to Michael Friedman, he pointed out that according to Purdue's own data, quote, physicians who attended dinner programs or weekend meetings wrote more than double the number of new prescriptions for OxyContin compared to the control group, end quote. The numbers are really scary. Just another, I have to like insert this. This is not to say that all doctors only care about money. In fact, what I'm trying to highlight is the way that perception and representation plays a major role. They weren't just buying them a meal and having the doctors write prescriptions. It's about what's being talked about at those meals, the way Purdue was using its massive influence and all of its companies to change the way that pain and treatment were being looked at. Pain was being looked at now as essentially the fifth measure of help, and it was being implied that doctors who aren't willing to help their patients' pain levels weren't being good doctors.
Oh, shit.
So it's not like they're like, here's money, prescribe our thing. It's the misinformation that they're being fed during these moments.
Yeah, to like feed on people's empathy levels.
Exactly.
That's diabolical.
Some doctors for sure were like money because, again, they're just people. But like you said, it's the diabolical nature of insinuating these doctors don't care about the people they're treating unless they're treating their pain with OxyContin. Mm-hmm. Quote, the primary goal of medical practice is the relief of suffering, and one of the most common types of suffering that doctors see is pain. David Gerlink, who runs the Division of Clinical Pharmacology and Toxicology at the University of Toronto, pointed out, you've got a patient in pain, and you've got a doctor who genuinely wants to help, and now suddenly you have an intervention that we are told is safe and effective. What the company was really selling, some of Purdue's marketing materials suggested, was hope in a bottle, end quote. that is why this company is to blame. And a lot of what this episode is going to be talking about is all of the things that Purdue knew in the first time that they got in trouble. The sales reps were offered very similar hope and like presented of like being part of the solution, mm-hmm. and also similar bonuses just in the form of money.
Yeah. Well, you have to make sure that they believe what they're selling or else it's never going to work.
Exactly. So if sales grew, you'd get a bigger bonus. And one of the biggest things that we hear throughout all of this is that, quote, Purdue never capped, the executive said, because they wanted all of their people to be incentivized. No cap on the bonuses that you can make.
Wow. That is quite the incentive.
So Stephen May is an ex-cop who lived in Roanoke, Virginia, and he worked as a sales rep for a rival pharmaceutical company before he joined Purdue in 1999. Quote, "We felt like we were doing a righteous thing," May recalled. "There's millions of people in pain, and we have the solution." May was one of 700 or so sales reps who called hundreds of thousands of doctors. As May put it, quote, "What Purdue did really well was target physicians, like general practitioners who were not pain specialists," end quote. Now, I didn't cover the advertising data company IMS solely for the reason of its role in separating the Sackler brothers, but I also covered it because of how it impacted the Sacklers' ability to do business. Over the decades, putting all of this information into a big data company with extraordinarily fine-grained information about the prescribing habits of physicians gave IMS the original algorithm, essentially, for who to target specifically and who was going to buy a lot of these pills. Places where there were a lot of family physicians, places that had a lot of people on workers' comp and injuries on sustained jobs, places with high disability rates, places with high numbers of poverty.
This really just feels like taking advantage of people.
Oh, completely.
100%. And I'm like, oh my God.
That's exactly what happened. According to sources, quote, "Purdue explicitly instructed sales reps to target family physicians who were likely to be naive about opioids, doctors who had little experience prescribing that medication," end quote. To May, it seemed that for some of these doctors, the primary source of knowledge about the use of opioids in pain management was Purdue itself, from the pain management clinics and conventions that they were hosting at universities all around the country, because they were the only ones hosting it. Stephen May's region comprised parts of Western Virginia and Southwest Virginia, which had, quote, "phenomenal growth," end quote, the second that Oxy was introduced into the market. There's this video where it's a bunch of people talking about how they're living in pain and they got their life back because they started taking this medication. And it doesn't make them drowsy and they can work and they can do all of these things. And it's so amazing. And that's just being played everywhere. And it's so important, like these weird selling programs that they had, because people talk a lot about like drug dealers all the time. But it's never in terms of pharmaceutical companies. So Purdue developed this card program in which the company would issue coupon cards that patients could then use to go receive a free 30-day prescription.
Oh my gosh, it's like the GoodRx thing, discount thing now, but just specifically for one drug company.
Yeah.
Wow.
By the time that this program was suspended in 2001, Purdue had subsidized 34,000 free prescriptions. 34,000 people on this drug simply because they got a month of it for free.
That is wild.
And that's to assume that each person who got one of those cards wasn't selling it. In the first year, Purdue sold $44 million worth of OxyContin. The following year, sales more than doubled. The year after that, they doubled again. I am pleased. Oh,
so what did we start at?
44 million.
Okay, so then that's 88. And then what's that, 16?
88 is like 116.
There you go. Thank you.
Maybe more than that.
I don't know what I said.
Maybe more than that.
Hold on. It gets hard. I'm not good at math. So 88 double.
176. LOL.
176. Okay.
I was like, yeah, 116 for sure.
Well, I was thinking 8 and then 16.
Yeah, same. But yeah. Same. I'm with you. Dude, ride or die. Women's rights and wrongs. Yeah, no, 116 for sure. Okay, so yeah, the year after that, they doubled again. That's 176 million. Quote, I am pleased to report sales through September 99 year to date of $601 million.
Oh my God.
Michael Friedman wrote to Richard, Raymond, and Mortimer Sackler, noting that OxyContin prescription trends continue to accelerate.
Oh my God. Mortimer.
Mortimer. There are stories about reps making six figures in a quarter.
In a quarter?
There's a tale about one rep in Myrtle Beach who supposedly made $170,000 in 3 months. And this is in the fucking 90s, y'all. According to former employees, on top of a base salary for starting reps of $50,000, there are 4 quarterly bonuses, an annual bonus, stock options, a car, a 401k, great health benefits, and a $60,000 expense account, end quote.
What the fuck?
It pays to be a drug dealer.
Yeah. Honestly.
In 2001, the average sales rep bonus on top of their annual salary was $71,000.
Shut the fuck up. And you're getting like quarterly bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
With some bonuses reaching as high as $240,000.
Stop that right now. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Because that's how many pills they're selling. That's the scary part, what that equates to in pills.
Yeah.
So Oxy is sold in ranges of dose, 10 milligrams, 20 milligrams, 40, and 80. In the year 2000, a colossal 160 milligram pill was introduced, which is interesting because there's actually an email that was found as court things came up where someone said, they're killing themselves with the 80s. Why would we come out with a 160? So just to be super clear, this was not a secret.
Yeah, they know what they're doing.
So according to the company, there was no, quote, no maximum daily dose or ceiling dose, end quote. Through Larry Wilson, the Purdue chemist who worked with OxyContin, felt 160 was a bit too much. So they pulled that from the shelves. Priced in such a way that the higher the dose, the more you pay. So the sales rep are also encouraged to sell higher doses. You can't get addicted. Why not just have a higher dose just in case? Is that not working for you anymore? What about a higher dose?
Has your system gotten used to it because you're addicted? How about you have some more?
Have you gained weight? How about a higher dose? Not that that actually matters. Since OxyContin is an opioid, this is super relevant because, as you mentioned, developing a tolerance, that is a natural occurrence to opioids. Mm-hmm. So a patient who starts with 10 milligrams twice a day is going to find eventually that this just will not be enough at some point. It is inevitable that that will happen. In theory, the range of OxyContin pills would be able to address this problem, and the patient could, quote, simply graduate from 10 milligrams to 20, and so on, all the way up to 160, and then when they pulled that, 80. Purdue had a program called Tappers, in which it recognized the leading sales reps from across the country. And as a reward for their efforts, the company sent the Tappers on an all-expenses-paid vacations all around the world, places like Bermuda. Within 4 years of the launch celebration, where we heard that fun song, You Make Me Want to Sell, OxyContin hit $100 billion in sales and surpassed the quintessential blockbuster era of that drug, Viagra.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is insane. I can't even...
It's so much. Within 5 years of its introduction, Purdue had more than doubled its sales force. So in 2001, the company paid $40 million just in bonuses. The fuck?
I could never even imagine having that much money.
No. No. The average annual bonuses for sales reps would climb to nearly $250,000, and the top reps earned much, much more. Insane. And like, to a lot of these people, they're like, oh my God, I'm making so much money and I'm changing people's lives. Like,
yeah,
my life is the best.
They like drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Because they're not doctors. Why would they lie?
Why?
Why? Barry Meyer, an investigative reporter at the New York Times, got a call one day in the early 2001 about the black market world of opioids. It had gotten to the point where Purdue could literally not make enough OxyContin to keep up with the demand for it.
Holy shit.
And I actually have like a little bit of notes about, I haven't been able to figure out how to put them in, mm-hmm. about how Johnson & Johnson fucked up Tanzania so that they could plant a shit, like they paid a bunch of farmers with cash and vacations and cars to stop growing potatoes and start growing opium. What? And then they like created this super poppy so that it would like make more of this special chemical. Like there's a whole subsection of like what Johnson & Johnson had to do in order to supply Purdue Pharma with all of the opium and poppy basically to make this. And that could be its own thing. That could be its own whole own other thing.
Wow.
Like the destruction, like, yeah, how heroin basically destroyed Tanzania. It's so much. And that is to say, as we know, with a massive demand of something, often is going to come illegal ways of filling that demand. Mm-hmm. So Barry starts talking to pharmacists and doctors who were like, this aggressive marketing is wild. And people are coming in and they're promoting this as non-abusable. But it's not tracking with what I, a doctor who's like reading studies, am seeing. Mm-hmm. So in February of 2001, they drop a front page story in the Times. Cancer painkillers pose new abuse threat. And here's a little quote. Harried police detectives in dozens of rural areas in eastern states are combating what they say is a growing wave of drug abuse involving a potent painkiller prescribed for terminal cancer patients and other people with severe pain. OxyContin, as it turned out, was not just a hit in the illicit marketplace, but on the black market as well. Once crushed, the drug can be snorted by addicts or dissolved for injection, Meyer and Klein's reported, and they identified instances of abuse, overdoses, and illegal trafficking of OxyContin in Maine, Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, and Maryland, end quote. The Appalachian mountain range was targeted very heavily. Coal mining, injuries, poverty, workers' comp.
On the black market as well, using the Appalachian Trail to transport across state lines and things like that was probably something that was done.
There was actually a very specific highway.
Oh.
Because people just drove it. It's just pills.
Yeah.
It's just my prescription. It's like the conversation we had with Spencer about tunnels. Mm-hmm. It's wild the amount of things that are just done out in the open.
Yeah.
They don't even need to hide it on the trail. They just...
hiding in plain sight?
But it's not even in plain sight. And I don't even know why I said hiding. There's reports of lines out the door for pain clinics.
Wow.
Out of state license plates that would just be like a Black Friday every single day. And it was totally legal. No problems. The laws were so loose that people didn't even have to hide the way this is happening. Barry's also catching stories like, quote, a doctor from Lewisburg, a small city in West Virginia, who had become one of Stephen May's top prescribers, whose relative had just died, a young girl who had overdosed on OxyContin. It was insisted that it was impossible to get high off of Oxys, but each bottle came with a warning that, in retrospect, quote, doubled as an inadvertent how-to, taking broken, chewed, or crushed OxyContin tablets could lead to rapid release and absorption of a potentially toxic dose of oxycodone, end quote. you can go into any pain clinic, get these free 30-day subscriptions, turn around and get high or sell the pills individually. And this is not news to Purdue at all. We now know for a fact that Purdue's lawyer, Howard Udell, had his legal secretary look into the abuse of OxyContin. Quote, he asked me to go on the internet and go into news groups, West would later recall. There were discussion boards online that were devoted to recreational drug use, and Udell wanted West to peruse them and find out how they're misusing the product. Lurking on the discussion groups, Wes found people talking about crushing OxyContin tablets, sucking the time-release coating off, snorting the drug, cooking it, or shooting it up with a hypodermic needle.
Whoa.
She wrote a memo outlining her findings, and according to testimony by Martha West, the memo was then circulated to numerous senior Purdue officials and to all the Sacklers who were actively involved in the company. End quote. This gorgeous quote from Empire of Pain sums it up very nicely. The truth was that well before Martha West wrote her memo, something was happening. Nobody could say precisely where or how it started, but the first hints of it cropped up in rural Maine and the Rust Belt of western Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio, in Appalachian areas of Virginia, West Virginia, and Kentucky. The abuse spread quickly, like some airborne virus, from one small community to the next. The regions where the problem began often had large number of people who were out of work or who worked hard manual labor jobs, people who were disabled or chronically ill, people who were suffering from pain. And as it happened, these were precisely the kinds of regions that Stephen May and other Purdue sales reps had targeted, regions that IMS data told them would be fertile terrain for OxyContin. In some cases, these communities also happen to have longstanding problems with prescription drug abuse. End quote. And they were directed there by data telling them this is going to make you a lot of money. It didn't take long for people to begin doctor shopping. So they would seek appointments with multiple doctors and stockpile prescriptions, sell them, share them with friends, and then either begin dealing to feed their own habit, black market pills start popping up, and suddenly everyone has access to being able to deal OxyContin. It starts to become very clear that the shadow sales of OxyContin dwarfs Purdue's own. Like, there are more illegal sales and people selling OxyContin than the actual hired people to sell it.
That's crazy.
Because it's just everywhere. Quote, some communities began to resemble a zombie movie as the phenomenon claimed one citizen after another, sending previously well-adjusted, functioning adults into spirals of dependence and addiction. In February of 2000, the federal prosecutor in Maine, Jay Mikulski, sent a letter to thousands of doctors across the state warning them about the increasing dangers of abuse and diversion of OxyContin. Udell and Purdue heard about this and immediately flew up, like the fucking mafia members that they are, to meet with him. And the prosecutor is like, hey, I'm very concerned about this. Kids are taking this drug. Quote, bright kids. It's ruining their lives. He found it a little strange that his small state had now become one of the highest consumers of OxyContin per capita in the nation. Mikulski mentioned that the jumbo 160 milligram pills, one of the doctors up here told me that one of the tablets could kill a kid if they swallowed it.
Oh my God.
He said, is that so? Probably, Udell and Friedman acknowledged. The meeting was frosty. End quote. Purdue's starting to see that officials are not backing down. They're like, all right, we need to figure out how to deal with this. So one of the ways that the company decided to handle this was say that we didn't hear this until right now. So they're like, February 2001, Jay, you're the first person who has ever told us that anyone is abusing this pill. Regardless of all of the memos of all of the letters of everything else, they're like, oh my God, this guy in Maine told us about this thing that's happening. Richard Sackler himself later testified under oath that the first time he ever heard of OxyContin being diverted or abused was early in the year 2000, which we know for a fact is not true because Purdue had been receiving notes from its own sales force dating as far back as 1997, informing the company that abuse is definitely happening. Years later, when investigators actually started searching through the reports that the Purdue reps filed between 1997 and 1999, they would find hundreds of references to words like street value, snort, and crush. In November of 1999, one Florida rep wrote an official at Purdue saying, quote, "I feel like we have a credibility issue with our product. Many physicians now think OxyContin is obviously the street drug all of the drug addicts are seeking," end quote. There is an email that a Purdue official forwarded to Sackler saying that the best ones are snorting the 40 milligrams because you're not snorting lots of filler, end quote. It is undeniable based on evidence that everyone at Purdue knew about this. And it's also getting to the point where it's pretty undeniable that this drug is causing people to die. Purdue's answer is saying it is not the drug. The problem is the people. Richard decreed, quote, "Purdue needs to drop the hammer on the abusers in every way possible. They are the culprits," and he declared, quote, "they are reckless criminals," end quote. They are the victims in this situation. These criminal addicts are making them look like these horrible people because they're misusing their amazing pill. It's not our fault that they chose to crush it up and snort this. Quote, "We're losing sales because physicians have become scared or intimidated from press reports," end quote. Michael Friedman complained to the Hartford Courant in 2001.
They're upset with the monster that they created. This is insane.
I want to be so fucking clear that this is intrinsically wrong, and I will explain now with science. Okay. The Cotton system was designed for people to take doses every 12 hours. The promise is that they would be pain-free, and during that time period, you have 12 hours of free pain. The original data shows, however, that the pill only provides relief for 8 hours. Since the beginning of this pill, it has not delivered what was promised. The human body naturally creates a tolerance to the opioids, meaning that it quickly grows used to a certain amount of the drug in your system to function and requires more to get relief, thus creating the withdrawal symptoms between doses. You are being told that this pill will treat you for 12 hours when they know it is only going to treat you for 8. They are selling you a pill where it is designed to put you through withdrawal. Prescribing a pill on a 12-hour cycle when it is known for many patients that it only works for 8 is quite literally a recipe for withdrawal and creates precisely the sorts of peaks and valleys that Purdue's sales reps claimed OxyContin avoided. In other words, this is a recipe for addiction. They created this addiction. It has nothing to do with people abusing the product. It has nothing to do with these, quote, dangerous criminal addicts who are snorting these pills. These are people who are taking the drugs exactly the way that they are prescribed. I was literally prescribed a morphine drip when I was in the hospital for 2 weeks for an infection. I wasn't in charge of how it was prescribed to me. It was given to me. I was then discharged from the hospital with absolutely no medication for afterwards. And I went through opioid withdrawal. And it was one of the most horrible experiences of my entire life.
Oh my God.
And that was just after 2 weeks of physical dependence. I cannot even fucking imagine what this would be like for a chronic pain user. For anyone to try and criminalize people for taking this pill and referring to them as reckless criminals or degrading them as abusers is disgusting. It makes me wish hell was real. I hope they go there. Like, fuck that. Not to mention that they are getting thousands of letters from patients who are both grateful and who are describing their issues. And if they had bothered to look at any of these letters, they would see most, if not all, of these people were talking about how this pill levels off for them after 8 hours. Mm-hmm. There's more evidence that they knew. Like, I just need to make it so clear and hammer home the point that anyone who is criminalizing or looking down on anyone who has ever been addicted to opioids needs to go fuck themselves. Like,
well said.
Such a giant fuck you, because it literally starts by being in a car accident or being injured and waking up and you've already been given these drugs, because that's just what hospitals used. So many people didn't have a choice. On top of all of this, the company knew that 20% of all OxyContin prescriptions were being written on a more frequent dosing schedule than for 12 hours. Meaning that when the New York Times article dropped about the concerns of this pill, the company knew it was a problem and still continued to deny it. Internal documents highlighting this addiction noted, quote, "These numbers are very scary," end quote. March of 2001, Purdue employee emailed their supervisor describing some data on the issue of withdrawal and wondering whether or not he should write the results up. And they were told not to, because doing so might add to the negative press. They're like, no, just don't write that up. There's a pain specialist who works for Purdue named David Haddix, and he's a former dentist who then retrained as a pain doctor. And he started hyping up OxyContin, basically. He likened it to a vegetable, being like, if I gave you a stalk of celery and you ate it, it would be healthy. But if you put it into a blender and tried to shoot it into your veins, that would not be good.
Like,
he's like, that's OxyContin. No.
Oh my God.
No. To Barry Meyer, he said that, I know, Goosey.
It's okay, Goose.
Goosey actually works for Purdue. She is a Sackler. To Barry Meyer, Haddix said that any overdose deaths that have been attributed to OxyContin, quote, typically involved multiple factors like alcohol, and warned that any exaggeration of the abuse problem might create undue obstacles for legitimate pain patients who were seeking the drug. This company starts literally weaponizing people's chronic pain to continue selling a drug that they know to be harmful. And Haddix had an answer for any question that was thrown his way. He's like, yes, people do tend up to build a tolerance, and it's not unusual for patients to begin experiencing withdrawals, but that's not addiction. That's pseudo-addiction. This is a completely coined, made-up term by this guy. He's like, this is not addiction. This is like physical addiction, because you guys are in pain and it makes you feel better. It's not real. If anyone hears anyone ever talk about pseudo-addiction, let me reiterate, it is not real. This term going around really started fucking up a lot of things, because they started saying things like pseudo-addiction stops once the pain is relieved. They started like creating pamphlets being like, they're not pseudo-addicted. It's, they're just in pain. And that people were like, okay. And believed it for a little while. And I wish I could explain it, but I can't. Early 2000s, I guess. I don't know. It gets to a point where these people who are told that they are selling hope and solving chronic pain can't handle the reality of what they're doing. They start to figure it out eventually. An insider, a company insider, a sales rep, reached out to Barry Meyer and wanted to meet. The rep would not give a name, and to this day, Meyer has still not divulged even the gender of his source. He has complete confidentiality, which I deeply respect. So they met, and the insider took something out of a bag. It was a piece of ruled notebook paper, and it was a handwritten list of names. It was 10 of them, and it was all the toppers at Purdue. Next to the toppers listed the area, the sales region, and he was given this list and was basically told, all right, look up what's going on here. Once he looked at the map and reports from all of these areas, if you looked at a map of where all of the toppers in the company were, those were exactly the same places that were having the highest overdose and addiction issues. Like a direct link. It's that map of missing people and caves, but it actually means something in this instance. Mm-hmm. And it's not just like interesting information. This was a direct correlation. So he took the number one person, Eric K. Wilson, whose territory was Myrtle Beach. And it turns out that Myrtle Beach had been known for what was called pill mills, pain clinics that were issuing prescriptions for almost anyone who asked. So this is what we were talking about before. There was a comprehensive care strip mall clinic in Eric Wilson's territory, and there was often a line out the door with 15 to 20 people waiting for prescriptions and cars with out-of-state license plates jammed in the parking lot from morning until night. Local pharmacists and law enforcement officials had tried to warn Purdue Pharma about the clinic, but of course the company did nothing about it. Purdue's sales in that district had surged by more than $1 million in a single quarter. It's the highest increase of any district in the country. In response to Meyer's inquiries, the company issued a statement saying it's not unusual for the volume of prescriptions of Oxycontin and other pain medications to change significantly from quarter to quarter. When Meyer reached out to Robin Hogan, the company spokesman, to ask about the huge volume of pills being sold in that one area, Hogan was dismissive. Oh, there are a lot of old people living in Myrtle Beach and they have a lot of pain. They have arthritis, so it's only natural. End quote. By his own admission, Barry became somewhat obsessed with proving what they knew and when they knew it, which led to his book, Painkiller, which is an incredibly detailed account of how the crisis spread from Maine to Mexico. And guess who just got it from the library and used it to fill in a lot of these notes. It is wild how much information Purdue knew about all of this.
It's crazy that we have access to it.
In the westernmost sliver of Virginia was a town of St. Charles, where Meyer found Dr. Art Van Zee, who was on a crusade against OxyContin after OxyContin hit this minor town like a tsunami. He said that 9% of the seventh graders in his town had tried OxyContin, and at least 25% of 11th grade. Quote, I was going in after midnight to take care of young people overdosing on OxyContin. I was quite unprepared for this. End quote. He gathered his community and started a petition to get the FDA to recall the drugs entirely. Dr. Art Van Zee continued to push and brought this issue all the way to the Senate to talk about the dangers of this drug. Quote, in general, the experience is if you've got an abusable drug that's highly available, it's going to be highly abused. End quote. Connecticut Senator Dodd, a Purdue company booster, pushed the idea that, quote, instead of blaming the company, why not blame the addicts for killing themselves? End quote. Which happened to be his stance. And afterwards, they happened to donate a amount that was 10 times larger to his campaign that they ever had in the past. This wasn't going to stop these people who were watching children and members of their towns die at alarming rates. So in Abingdon, Rick Mountcastle put together a secret document known as a prosecution memo. So he grabbed all of this incriminating evidence that different prosecutors from different states had laid out. And this document was dated September 28th, 2006. It's more than 100 pages long. It was 5 years of investigation with meticulous notes. I mean, we are talking corporate malfeasance, a spelled out, like, litany of prosecutable misdeeds, forensic detail of knowledge, just wild amount of paperwork being like, we are going to fuck Purdue. The highlight of this was the sworn testimony of Friedman, Goldheim, and Udell that was flatly contradicted by the company's own documents. They're like, we have proof that Purdue executives had testified falsely and fraudulently to Congress. And they wanted to bring multiple felony charges against these three executives, including misbranding, which was a fraud charge involving mislabeling of pharmaceutical products, wire fraud, mail fraud, and money laundering. Many sources highlighted this point from Patrick R. Keefe, quote, prosecutors are often reluctant to file criminal charges against publicly traded companies because of a fear that the stock price plummets, it could create financial losses for shareholders who might not have had any knowledge of the criminal conduct in question, end quote, which does make sense. Like, people who have invested shouldn't be fucked because these people have done things that were illegal and they had no idea. However, back to the quote, in the case of Purdue, there's no mom and pop shop stockholders. There were only the Sacklers. The prosecution memo told the story of an intricate, years-long, extraordinarily profitable criminal conspiracy. The company's records indicated that Purdue had already sold more than $9 billion of OxyContin. The evidence that they compiled was described as overwhelming. But after a meeting in 2006, they were informed that, quote, notwithstanding the evidence he and his prosecutors had spent 5 years assembling, the department would not support them seeking felony charges against the three executives. Instead, the company could be indicted for felony misbranding, and Friedman, Goldheim, and Udell could each be charged with a single misdemeanor. Brownlee was rip shit pissed, a former justice official who spoke with him at the time recalled. Rick Mountcastle and Randy Ramsayer were apocalyptic, end quote. They got away with it. That is not to say that people now are understanding of how this happened. Even now, this behind closed doors decision at the Justice Department is still a mystery because none of the officials involved are willing to own it. Patrick R. Keefe says this, quote, the choice to drop felony charges against Friedman, Goldheim, and Udell appears to have been made by the Assistant Attorney General, Alice Fisher. But several attorneys who worked with Fisher at the time stressed that she did not have the authority to overrule a U.S. attorney like Brownlee. And as such, she must have been carrying out the orders of her boss, the Deputy Attorney General, Paul McNulty. Fisher, who rarely speaks about internal deliberations during her time at Justice, made an exception to insist that I did not make or overrule any charging decisions on this case, which would seem to indicate that it must have ultimately been McNulty's call. John Brownlee recalled meeting with McNulty personally to talk about this case, but in an interview, McNulty claimed that he didn't make the decision to downgrade the charges against the executives, and indeed, he was not consulted in any way. It was an orphan directive, a backroom deal for which none of these former public servants would take responsibility, end quote. So no one is willing to be like, yeah, I did this, but somehow it just happened. Quote, this was a political outcome that Purdue bought, end quote. One former justice official who was involved in the case said. Another former official who reviewed the prosecution memo reflected, this is the reason we have a Department of Justice, to prosecute these kinds of cases. When I saw the evidence, there was no doubt in my mind that if we had indicted these people, if these guys had gone to jail, it would have changed the way that people did business, end quote. The team kept pushing. In the end, the company agreed to take a guilty plea to criminal charge of felony misbranding. Friedman, Goldheim, and Udell each pled guilty to a misdemeanor count of misbranding, as well as were barred for a period of 20 years from doing business with any taxpayer-financed healthcare program like Medicare. The exclusion period was subsequently reduced to 12 years. The men also accepted a sentence of 3 years of probation and 400 hours of community service. Purdue also had to pay a $600 million fine. This was supposed to represent a major step in reform at Purdue, but the company treated it like a speeding ticket. Shortly after the settlement in Virginia, the Sacklers voted to expand Purdue's sales force by hiring 100 additional reps because it was time to get back to selling OxyContin. One day in the summer of 2010, without really any warning at all, Purdue stopped shipping out the original OxyContin pills that it had been creating for nearly 15 years at this point, mm-hmm. and replaced them with a new kind of OxyContin oh. that had been subtly reformulated. At a glance, the pills looked almost identical. The only difference was that the new pills were slightly thicker and that one was stamped, they weren't stamped with OC, they were now stamped with OP. It's interesting because they were essentially trying to fix a problem that they said didn't exist and wasn't their fault. They were creating an abuse-resistant version of OxyContin, and if they made too much noise about that, it could be interpreted concession that the drug they were selling before this was actually dangerously susceptible to addiction.
Yeah. They're like, well, we can't admit it.
We have this one now. And they quietly applied for FDA approval in late 2007. And it was in 2010 that the agency granted Purdue permission to market this new abuse-resistant OxyContin. I, however, want to note, they had been selling this for around 15 years. And as we discussed in previous episodes, the original patent for drugs only lasts for 20.
Mm-hmm.
That was about to run out. And with this new one, it restarts. Quote, Purdue filed papers with the FDA asking the agency to refuse to accept generic versions of the original formulation of OxyContin, the version the company had been selling all these years, on the grounds that it was unsafe. The company said it was voluntarily withdrawing the original formulation from the market because of safety. And on the very day that the patent for the original formulation was set to expire, the FDA, ever obliging, declared that the benefits of the old version of OxyContin no longer outweigh the risks. Purdue is gratified that the FDA has determined OxyContin extended release tablets were withdrawn for sale for the reasons of safety, the company said in a press release, noting that the FDA would not accept or approve any application for the generic version of the drug. OxyContin continued to sell well in its new formulation. It was the best-selling painkiller in America, with more than $3 billion in annual sales, almost double the number of its nearest competitor drug. They are so diabolically evilly brilliant. Like, that is so fucking wild. These numbers, however, like, the numbers that they start coming out, really just like go and show how much more addictive their old pills were. So they have studies during the months following the reformulation, sales of the traditional OxyContin in Windsor, Ontario suddenly quadrupled. So Windsor sits just across the border from Detroit, and this was like a clear indication that the pills are being purchased in Canada and smuggled back into the US and sold on the black market. There were online forums of longtime users who were swapping stories about the great lengths in which they had gone to get their old pills or to get the same extract from, you know, their fix from these new fills. For some users, the reformulation of OxyContin triggered a transition to other more readily abusable prescription opioids, but many unfortunately graduated to heroin instead. Chemically speaking, the two drugs are closely related, and in some ways, heroin had always been the benchmark for OxyContin. In 2019, a team of economists from Notre Dame, Boston University, and the National Bureau of Economic Research published a long research paper on the timing of the, quote, rapid rise in the heroin death rate in the years since 2010. And the paper was titled, How the Reformulation of OxyContin Ignited the Heroin Epidemic, end quote. This was the first slap on the wrist that Purdue will face. We will discuss the next 14 years of Purdue and how their latest settlement made it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Wow. The next 14 years.
Yeah.
This family is wild. This shit is crazy. I feel like I just don't have even any more words to express how insane all of this is because it just keeps getting worse.
I thought I knew what I was getting into. And it's so much worse than I thought. And like, I keep stopping and being like, I swear, guys, doctors are good people.
I swear. That's not what I'm trying to say.
Because it's just so much human error and human greed, like compiled into destroying millions of lives. It's wild. But yeah, one more episode. I don't care how long the episode is. I need to be done with the Sackler family.
It needs to be over with.
They haunt my dreams.
All right. Well, thank you, Katie. Until next week. Bye.
Bye. You too, Grace.
She had to get it in there.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at al2kpodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/al2kpodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.